Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
In 2017, Reading author Kelly Ramsey had an MFA from the University of Pittsburgh, but found herself wanting a job that would allow her to be outside all the time. She became a hotshot wilderness firefighter in Northern California. In her memoir, Fire Days, A Woman, A Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West, Kelly Ramsey takes us through 2 years of fighting wilderness fires as the only woman with an elite firefighting crew. Kelly Ramsey, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, your book, the title, A Woman, A Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. So we figure, okay, the woman is you. The Burning American West, that's us. We know Northern California. But a hotshot crew, I didn't know hotshot had a specific meaning. In fact, you, in the beginning, you don't tell us till after page 300, that your reaction, what's a hotshot?
Yeah, I thought somebody was just sort of bragging and saying that they were cool or special, you know? I was like, oh, you really think you're a hotshot, huh? But no, it's an official designation for a type of firefighting crew. And there's a very specific set of requirements in order to become a hotshot crew and to retain that status. So a lot of it has to do with the physical training and, you know, the ability to move quickly over the landscape, carrying heavy weight, to run and hike and do pull-ups and push-ups, all of that. But it also is about a lot of technical skills, you know, the ability to conduct a really complex burning operation and to construct fire line quickly. So, yeah, it has to do with the physical and the mental side of the job. And then hotshot crews, once they're qualified, are assigned to some of the toughest parts of wildfires, the most remote territory or the most sort of difficult or technical assignment.
Well, I have a friend with the Fire Safe Council, and when I showed her your book, she was impressed. To quote her, it takes a very strong person to do that job. And then she had a question, how did you like her book? A writer friend of mine also said, yeah, when I told him about the book, he says, yeah, but is she a good writer? And I had to say, yes, indeed she is. Oh. So I really appreciated your talent, your skill as a hotshot firefighter, but also as a writer. So you tell your story. You tell us how you got involved with this occupation. And you weren't born in California. Where were you born?
I was born in Frankfort, Kentucky, and then lived there until I was about 7 years old, and then was raised in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So I'm from sort of a combination of the Southeast and the East.
So again, you decided you really wanted to be outside and be with nature. And you tell us what it was like when you decided, okay, well, how did you even decide to join the firefighters? There you were with an MFA, and you could have been a writer and a poet. Why did you decide to join the hotshots?
A great question. I had been working on my writing for a long time on the side of always having another job, another career. I had run a nonprofit for a while, kept trying to work on my writing, and I sort of reached this point where I hadn't given up. I was still writing, but I thought maybe it's never really going to happen. It's not going to really become a job for me. I might never publish a book. So I need to find something else to do that's actually fulfilling, as opposed to kind of marking time with these day jobs that aren't right for me. So I wanted to get into working outdoors, and I didn't really have any experience. So I saw this job posting for a volunteer wilderness ranger in Happy Camp. And the posting was very intriguing. It was like, you know, come and volunteer for the summer and gain all the skills you need to launch your career in public lands. And I was like, this is it. This is exactly what I need. It's everything I'm looking for. So I applied and got into the program, which, you know, it's volunteer, not that competitive. But then I saved my money, quit my job, put everything in storage in Texas, and just drove out to Happy Camp. I had never been there. I knew hardly anything about it. I had spent very little time in California at all. I didn't know anything about fire. So everything came as a shock. And from that very first summer working on a trail maintenance crew in Happy Camp, you know, that is kind of the epicenter, or one of the epicenters, there are many, of fire in California. So I saw wildfires, the town filled with smoke, and I started to get really curious about fire and how it moved across the landscape and how it's fought and managed. And I had some roommates who were female wildland firefighters, and they just seemed so strong, and they seemed so empowered and brought to life by the work. And I was like, this seems really cool. I want to try this. So somebody suggested I applied to this hotshot crew, and I did. Again, not really knowing what I was getting myself into.
Well, I was impressed by the fact that this wasn't your first venture, just going out and walking through through nature, I guess you might say. You made a trip to Peru, and you say that trip lit a spark. That you'd been you were familiar with rural Kentucky. You go to Peru, and I was impressed because I've been to Cusco and Machu Picchu, and when you talked about hiking there, oh boy, I was quite impressed that you hiked to Machu Picchu, Kelly.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did the not the traditional trek, but I did this other trek called Salkantay, which is like a 5-day kind of longer loop around that ends at Machu Picchu. And that's another funny story. Apparently, this is just something that I do. I had never been backpacking before.
Wow.
I thought it sounded cool. And so I had borrowed some gear, you know, before I flew to Peru, I borrowed some backpacking gear because I knew that's what people do in Peru. And then I was in a hostel because I had gone to Peru by myself. In a hostel, I just ran into this guy from Portland and we hit it off. And I was like, hey, I want to do this backpacking trip. Do you want to go? And he was like, yeah, sure. He was a very experienced backpacker. So he agrees to go. And somewhere in the middle of us prepping for this trip and buying all of our supplies and gear, I had said to him, you know, like, this is so cool, my first backpacking trip. And he turned to me and was like, what? You've never been backpacking and the first trek you're going to do is this grueling hike to like 11,000 feet? And I was like, yeah.
Well,
that's what I'm doing.
Well, like him, I was impressed also with that, your boldness, I guess is the word I'm thinking of.
It might be foolishness, though. You know, you never know.
No, I think that was quite an adventure. So back to California, you decide, okay, here's, I'm going to go to California. You do, and you weren't familiar with Happy Camp, but that's where you went. Well, you were in Texas, and why don't you read us a section from your book, early in the book, and give us the background when you say less than a year after hang up the phone on that Texas porch. What
sure.
did you do?
Okay. So this is in chapter one. It's about 14 pages into the book. Less than a year after hanging up the phone on that Texas porch, I ended a relationship, shoved my things into a storage unit, and drove to California. There, I found that the outdoors could be more than an escape. You could make a life out there, even a career. The volunteer position I took on a trail crew soon became a paying job as a wilderness ranger. Happy Camp and the U.S. Forest Service took me in. Over the next 2 years with the Klamath National Forest, I learned the difference between a ponderosa and a Jeffrey pine. It's in the texture, gentle Jeffrey, prickly ponderosa. I could distinguish the hoot of the aggressive barred owl from that of the reclusive northern spotted owl. I could navigate the Marble Mountain Wilderness by feel, buck a log with a crosscut saw, replace a trail sign, dig a new trail, or rescue a lost hiker. I could read water well enough to float Class 4 rapids in an inflatable kayak. I knew the cry of the red-tailed hawk, the secret swimming holes on every creek, and where to pick blackberries when they ripened in July. My second summer on the forest, I lived in a government barracks with female firefighters. Ladies who could do hundreds of push-ups and run a 6-minute mile. They came home from assignments reeking of wood smoke, faces smudged with ash. Though they claimed to be exhausted, they were lit up, as if brought to life by fire. I had dated a firefighter my first summer out there, and I'd admired his chiseled physique, but seeing the women was different. As we held pull-up contests in the kitchen doorway, and as I watched them come and go, muscular and unapologetic in heavy leather fire boots, I was smitten with a new vision of what a woman could be. In a word, strong. That summer, I got red carded, or qualified as a wildland firefighter. Doing so required online courses in firefighting methods and successful completion of the PAC test, a 3-mile walk wearing a 45-pound weight vest, to be finished in under 45 minutes. Since I'd been backpacking all summer for work, a 6-foot crosscut saw, like the old 2-handled lumberjack saw, balanced on one shoulder, I blitzed through the PAC test, hardly breaking a sweat.
This is Reading author Kelly Ramsey reading from her book, Wildfire Days. And you, that word came up that my friend with the Fire Safe Council used. She says it takes a very strong person to do that job. Mm. And I interpret that as strong in both physical and emotional, a strong person, a strong personality and a strong body to do what you did.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned some of the equipment in what you just read, and as a reader, I appreciated the illustration you have early in your book that shows us, and I assume this is you because here's a woman with a braid, long hair and braid, and some of the equipment that she is carrying, and you also list that equipment in your book, and it's rather staggering, I think. You listed what the crew was required to carry, just required now. That didn't count all the optional items.
Right.
And out of this 20, the very first item you list was just water that weighed 16 pounds just for the water.
Yeah.
What are some of the other required items on your carry list, Kelly?
Yeah, so the water, you have to carry food. So the expectation is that you could be out there for, 24 hours and you would be self-supported. You know, you're not going back in to get anything. So we do meals ready to eat, MREs, usually in that situation. So 2 of those, you have leather gloves, a headlamp, a fire shelter, which is what you would use, if you thought you were going to be burned over and you had to do what's called a deployment, which is like cover yourself as the fire comes over you, carry that shelter, eye protection, batteries, flagging and tape, first aid kit. We usually all carry some form of fuel or oil for the chainsaws. There's rope.
So that would be heavy, I would think.
Yeah, that's along with the water. Those are 2 of the heaviest things. Rope, glow sticks, wedges, it goes on.
Well, this also brings up the vocabulary. You guys had your own language, it seemed to me.
Yeah.
For example, the container for those bottles of fuel or bar oil was called a domar, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Shortened dolly.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other firefighters would know what you meant if you referred to a dolly.
Yeah.
And of course, you had all this equipment that a chainsaw, now that must be heavy, but
yeah.
You didn't have to carry the chainsaw though, right?
No, because I wasn't on a saw team. The whole crew is divided kind of into 2 parts. So there's all the sawyers in the front, and then there's the dig in the back. And those are the people with hand tools who dig in the dirt to create the actual fire line itself. So I was part of the dig. So I usually would carry my hand tool, a Pulaski, and then often you try to carry something extra. So a fiver, again, the lingo, a fiver is a 5-gallon jug of fuel or water, whatever it is that you need. Or I would try to carry a dolmar of fuel. You always try to grab, something extra, especially as a rookie on the crew.
Now, another term that you use the word buggy. And I think the average person, buggy, they had a buggy? What's that?
Yeah, it's a 10-person crew carrier. So it's kind of like a truck. It has a big cab in the front and then a big box in the back. And I don't know if you remember, I used this reference and somebody else didn't know what I was talking about, but the Schwann's truck, the food delivery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It looks a little bit like a cross between that and like a short bus. So the box in the back has windows along the sides. So you fit 8 people in the back of it in these big captain's chairs, and then 2 people are up front in the cab. And if it's Forest Service, it's like this sort of pale green color, the whole vehicle. So Now you might notice, you might see them on the road because they're all over Northern California. Starting this time of year, you'll see the buggies along with, you know, fire engines from the Forest Service.
And you mentioned the things that you had to carry in case you got stuck out there for 24 plus hours, because you never knew when you might get stuck out there. So you had to be prepared for whatever circumstances you found yourself in. And that's impressive.
Absolutely. You go out and you think you're working a 16-hour shift, which is standard. And then all of a sudden, you know, the fire conditions change and you get rolled into a 24 or 30-hour shift and you just have to, you know, shift gears and keep going. So, yeah, you have to be ready.
So you worked with a group called the Rowdy River Hotshots. And how did you choose the Rowdy River Hotshots? There must have been other choices.
Yeah. So that is a pseudonym for the crew, by the way.
I figured.
Yeah.
Because, in fact, when I Googled, I said, Rowdy River? Where's the Rowdy River? And I thought, well, I looked and there's a Rowdy Creek, but I thought you must have renamed that.
Yeah, I renamed the crew and the river and the town and all the people on the crew just, you know, to maintain every privacy.
Yeah, I figured you renamed the crew members, gave them different names, but I noticed that you also renamed the group.
Yeah, so I guess to answer your question, the crew known as Rowdy River in the book,
yes.
I chose them. So yeah, you have to be within what's called a 2-hour callback. So wherever you live and wherever the crew station is located, there can only be 2-hour drive between those things at most, because at any moment you could get a fire assignment and, you know, they'd basically be like, you need to be here right now, as in within 2 hours. So you have to be within 2 hours of the station because you could be called in at any time. So I, you know, looked at a map, looked at the driving distances, and there were about 3 different crews within that 2-hour callback zone from where I lived in Happy Camp. And one of them, I had an ex-boyfriend who worked there, so that was out. One of them was just sort of a more perilous drive, and I had heard some less than savory things about that crew, and then that left Rowdy River. And not only had I heard only good things about the crew, but it was located in this absolutely beautiful spot on this gorgeous river that, you know, has never been dammed. And the river runs kind of right behind the compound, and the Forest Service compound is just like pristine and beautiful. And, you know, everything about it just felt like this really sweet, special spot. So I was like, I think that's the one.
My guest is Reading author Kelly Ramsey. Her book is Wildfire Days, A Woman, A Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Reading author Kelly Ramsey, who's telling us about her days as a wildfire fighter. Well, I mentioned that I appreciated your illustration of the equipment and of what you wore, but I also really appreciated the maps, because you recount 2 years that you spent with this Rowdy River Hotshots. And you give us a map for the first year, which was 2020, and the second year, 2021. So thank you for those maps.
Okay.
In fact, you even mentioned in your book yourself, you say, I liked maps for their own sake. I thought, right on, Kelly. I like maps also.
You're a map lover? Yeah.
Oh, I am, because I like to see how things relate to each other.
Exactly. Yeah. I like to see sort of like, you know, what direction would you go to get from here to here? And where is this mountain in relationship to this town? Yeah. I love a map.
Now, I've mentioned some of the vocabulary, the language that you spoke among yourselves. And for example, day one, somebody would call out, day one. What did that mean?
So, yeah, day one means, you know, in theory, just, you know, the first day. So, like, the first day of work, we got there, and at the end of the day, somebody starts to say it, and then everybody shouts together, day one. But what I came to realize was that on that crew, they shouted it at the end of every single day.
Yes.
And I really like that as a life philosophy, you know, not just a philosophy for firefighting, but like every day is its own first day, right? Every day is a new beginning. And so especially in a job where you go on these 14-day assignments and everybody kind of counts up and then down. It's like everyone sort of is counting like, oh, okay, we're on day five. And then when you get to day nine, everybody says five finger countdown. You know, we only have five more days in this assignment until we get a couple days off. So in a job where you can be tempted to kind of like mark time in that way and always be counting down, the idea of always saying day one, you know, it keeps every day as its own new, fresh experience. And I just love that.
My guest is Reading author Kelly Ramsey. The title of her book, Wildfire Days, A Woman, A Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. Now, speaking of this language that you speak, something that comes up is the phrase, close the gap.
Mm.
When would you hear close the gap, Kelly?
Oh, it's a very dreaded phrase for me and most people, I think, who've done this job. So when you're hiking, you know, we hike as a crew and you're in a single file line and you're supposed to keep only 2 feet at most between the heels of the person in front of you and where your toes are hitting the ground. So you're hiking really right up on the back of the person in front of you, especially considering there's a pack between you as well. And if you start to fall behind and that space opens to 3 or 4 feet, that's called gapping out. You know, a gap is opening between you and somebody behind you, one of the overhead, that's one of the people in charge, will start saying, close the gap. And you know that you've been warned, because what happens is if that gap opens to 6 feet or more, then the people behind you have permission, unspoken, they just have permission to pass you. So that gap opens up, somebody says, close the gap. You're like, oh no, I need to catch up or people are going to start passing me and I'm going to end up in the back of this line, which is very shameful, you know, within fire culture. So dreading.
Well, how did you have the, I guess, strength, stamina to keep up with, I mean, first of all, being a woman and you aren't expected as a woman, perhaps, to be as strong as a man. So you kind of had to prove yourself. Did you feel that way?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I felt that I needed to prove myself, you know, both to the men and to myself. You know, I wanted to know that I could keep up and that I could pull my weight, so to speak. Yeah, it is definitely different. I mean, the thing is, I think that the idea that women are necessarily weaker is a stereotype, because I know women who can do, you know, more pull-ups than men. And I know women who are faster runners than huge men. My friend Gabby is like 5'2" and she can outrun anybody. She's a firefighter. So, you know, there are these women who are faster and stronger than men, but, I, at least to start, was not one of those women. So I was one of the slow ones at the beginning and felt this huge pressure to keep up in order to earn their respect and in order to respect myself as well. And so I would just train after work. I would add weight to my pack and I would go out on the weekend and I would hike with a chainsaw. I just did whatever I needed to do to get stronger. And you also kind of develop techniques. So like, you know, a man who's 6'4", if he wants to go from point A to point B, maybe he takes 10 steps because of his stride length. But me, I'm 5'6". To cover the same distance, I might have to take 15 or 20 steps to cover that distance in the same, you know, with the same speed. So what I learned was that I had to really like fast step and do these like quicker, littler steps in order to keep up the same pace as a person who's larger than me. So you get these, you know, little ways that you figure it out and game it out in order to make it work.
And then also, you're climbing up a mountain, for example, and if I were just to climb up a mountain with no extra weight, I think I would find that a challenge. But but you had to carry extra weight. How many pounds extra did you have to, say, if you were hiking up a mountain, how many pounds, extra pounds did you have to carry?
So the minimum, you know, that list that we went over of all the things you're required to carry, that weighs at least 45 pounds. So, you know, you're just bare minimum required to carry that. But then, you know, you have all the gear on your body and your boots, and then you have your tool. So all of that probably adds at least another 10 pounds. And then often, as I said, you're carrying something extra, you know, a jug of water or fuel or something else. So it gets to be more like 60 to 70 pounds a lot of the time.
Yeah, because that didn't count the optionals, just the required.
Right.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that this list of required items was listed in the booklet. And the booklet had a cute name. What was the booklet called?
The Handy Dandy. It was made, you know, just the size that it fits in your pocket. And we have this, everything has a funny name. We have this little Velcro pouch called the Man Purse that has a lot of our necessary, like, reference materials go in that, and often, like, a lighter and a Sharpie and some other things. And the Handy Dandy would go in the Man Purse in your pocket.
My guest is Kelly Ramsey. She lives in Reading now, but she spent 2 years as a firefighter. The title of her book is Wildfire Days, A Woman, a Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. Now, when you were walking, when you were a member of this hotshot crew, the years 2020, 21, people might wonder, well, Kelly, was COVID ever a problem for your group?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It was and it wasn't. So, you know, we were in that really unique category of kind of essential workers, I guess. You know, we had to go to work, even though COVID lockdowns and shutdowns were happening. And we also, as a crew, you have to work together. You know, there's no way for you to maintain a 6-foot spacing at all times. You ride in vehicles together. You work shoulder to shoulder, pretty much. So we had like this kind of bubble of just our crew. And we, when we came on for the season, we all went and got like a baseline COVID test, and then mostly tried to just spend time with each other and our families. And, you know, it wasn't like you can't socialize, but the idea was, you know, you're kind of supposed to keep it tight. And then we were periodically tested for COVID throughout the seasons, and we would have, you know, temperature checks. Actually, there was a long period of time where in order to get into a fire camp, you had to get your temperature checked to make sure you weren't sick. And then they'd put this wristband on you, almost like a wristband you'd get at like a festival or a party or something. It's a paper wristband that proved that you had had a temp check. So there were, you know, all these interesting precautions, but we still had to go out there and fight fire.
Well, if you, say, you tested positive for COVID, could you just take off and take sick leave, say? Could that be a problem?
It would be a huge problem. I mean, you could take sick leave, but firefighters only make, you know, pretty low hourly wage when they're on what's known as base pay, which is when you're not on a fire. So it's a little bit better now, but I was making $16.33 an hour base pay. Whereas when you're on a fire, you make overtime and hazard pay. So you make 1.75 times as much money, almost 2 times as much money. So firefighters are really reliant on going out on those fire assignments in order to make a living wage, because you only really work, you know, 6 months of the year, and then most people get laid off in the winter. So it created this really terrible situation during COVID where if people did start to feel sick, they didn't want to tell anyone, because not only would they be sent home, but the whole crew could be pulled off the fire and quarantined and tested and sent home. And so everyone's losing out on thousands and thousands of dollars that they desperately need in order to pay their bills and feed their families.
So winter comes along, and what do you do during the winter when you have time off, Kelly?
So, well, you train for the next season, for one thing. For me, yeah, I mean, most people go on unemployment because you've effectively, like, you've been laid off from your job. You've lost your job in a way. So I went on unemployment, and for me, you know, I did some writing and tried to travel and see family. Some people take other jobs during the winter, but a lot of what you do, at least starting in, say, December, January, is just to start training for the next season. So it's really interesting because you're not being paid for your job, but you're doing hours a day of work just to get physically ready for the next fire season.
So if you were doing some writing, was it like keeping a journal for your experiences, or were you writing? Because I didn't mention the fact that your writing has appeared in the Washington Post, Sierra, Electric Literature. So was the writing that you would do, say, during the winter, just keeping a diary? What kind of writing did you do?
I always keep a journal. Actually, until recently, I have a child, and somehow journaling has really flown out the window. But I always kept a journal then, and I was also, as you said, I started to get into writing about fire because I was so interested in, captivated by what I had experienced, and I really felt that there was a lack of understanding from the general public about what wildland firefighters do, what the job is really like, and some of the struggles that these people face. So I think it was the winter between my two seasons that I first started writing, you know, some op-eds and opinion pieces about fire. And that grew over time after I left the job. You know, I started writing more reported pieces. I've written a few for Sierra Magazine that are more sort of like deeply reported stories about fire and how it affects communities. So that's been really fun and interesting. I'm not educated as a journalist at all, so it's been really cool to learn how to do that kind of writing as well.
Well, I figured you must have kept a diary because your memoir is so detailed about what was happening that I figured you had to have kept a diary.
Yeah, I did.
Now, you mentioned when you would go home for the winter, I was impressed that you were a dog lover, Kelly, and you had to leave your animals when you would go off to fight fires, and you would just get to see them when you would come back home.
It was so hard.
Yeah, I felt bad for them and for you.
Yeah, for that reason. Yeah, I felt really bad for them because, you know, my partner and I at the time is we would find somebody who needed somewhere to live for the summer. So usually like a seasonal. First year was this lovely young woman who was working for the timber department for the Forest Service. And we gave her a free place to live in our home in exchange for being our like live-in animal sitter. So then when we went on fires, she would be there, you know, just living with the dog. So they had somebody, but you know, if you're a dog lover, you know that like your dog loves you.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Your dog wants you only. So it was really hard.
Well, I also want to ask you about the levels of preparedness. I think the general public has some idea, but would you explain to us what was meant by level one or level five preparedness?
Sure. Yeah. So the PL or preparedness level measures basically how ready firefighting resources are to handle a fire. And mostly it's how many resources are available relative to how many fires are happening. So early in the season, I could look it up. I won't take the time to do it right now, but I could look up where we are today, you know, so I bet that we're only at like a PL of one or two, meaning that there aren't many very big fires going on throughout the country. And so a lot of resources are just kind of standing by and they're available. So if some big fire happened, you could pull a bunch of resources without any problem and staff that fire. But by July or August of every year, that number creeps up and eventually you hit the highest level, PL5, which basically means almost everyone is committed. You know, the incident management teams, the various crews, fire engines, you know, most people are already out on a fire. So if you have a new major incident start at that time and you're requesting a bunch of resources to come to your incident, your requests might not be fulfilled. You know, you might ask for 5 hotshot crews and you only can get 1 because they're all assigned elsewhere. So what starts to happen is that everyone is stretched very thin and all these major incidents are understaffed. Because there just aren't enough firefighters to go around. So, you know, when you hit PL5, you know that things are getting a bit dicey out there. And at this point, it happens every year.
My guest is telling us about her book, Wildfire Days. She spent 2 years with a hotshot crew, and you would have winter off, so you would go home and be with your animals. So when you were available as a firefighter, what were your accommodations then? Where did you live?
So my first summer, I lived in a government barracks on the compound, you know, where we worked. And that was 2 hours from where my actual home was. So during the week, you know, before we went out on fires, during the week, I would live at the barracks. And on the weekend, I would drive over the mountain and be at home. Once the season started, you know, you're out and you're just sleeping on the ground on the fire. The second season, I decided not to pay for the government barracks because you have to pay rent on that. And then I was already paying for housing at home. So I slept in my truck. I got a camper top for my pickup truck and just slept in the back of it, and either sort of at a campground, or sometimes they'd let us be kind of on the fringes of the government compound. And there was a whole bunch of people that kind of referred to ourselves as dirt bags who had campers or vans. You know, some people had really cool, you know, like beautiful decked out vans. But a lot of us, it was like some dingy old camper or the back of our pickup truck. And a lot of us lived that way for the first part of the season. And then once you start going on fires, you're only home for a couple days at a time. And you usually go back to your house during that time. So you're not really sleeping in the truck that often.
After a break, wildland firefighter Kelly Ramsey and I will continue our conversation about her memoir, Wildfire Days. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Reading author Kelly Ramsey, who spent 2 years fighting fires with a hotshot crew. The title of her book is Wildfire Days, A Woman, a Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. Well, I think most of us would realize that it can be a very dangerous job that you're doing. Of course, some firefighters lose their lives. But even just not even a fire, you had a member of your crew named Wink, and mm-hmm. he lost a tooth.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So horrible. Yeah. Little things like that. I mean, little, but not little. Right. Those sorts of things happen all the time. So, yeah, he was just following another firefighter up this tiny hill, not even really a hill, just like a cut bank off the side of the road. And the captain had his tool tucked into the back of his pack. So it stuck out like, you know, the stinger on a wasp kind of. But the tool handle is wooden. It's very heavy. And so he kind of slipped and the tool just came up and hit Wink in the chin, well, in the mouth. And yeah, broke one of his front teeth completely clean off. And he turned around and, you know, I'm gasping just because I thought he got hit and was hurt in some way. I didn't even think about his teeth. And he turns around and there's just blood covering his mouth and running down his chin. So things like that are, you know, it's so easy. It happens in a split second. And that's not even to speak of, you know, the much bigger tragedies that happen every single year. You know, it's about 15 to 20 firefighters perish on average every summer doing this job.
Well, we as reader, we felt bad for Wink. We felt sorry for him. But I also felt sorry for the guy who certainly didn't do it on purpose, but whose tool hit Wink and caused him to lose the tooth. So I felt bad for both of those guys.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he felt so terrible, too. Yeah.
Now, there was another time you guys are out sawing down trees, felling trees, and there was a member of your group named Luke who was hit by a tree.
Yeah. So this is actually one of the greatest risks to wildland firefighters. Tree strikes are one of the main things that kill firefighters. So what happens is, you know, a tree will burn out at the base. It'll burn, you know, clean through on the bottom and then just fall over and fall across the fire line and strike somebody. And yeah, that's what happened to Luke and Wink, the guy who had lost the tooth. Wink and I were on either side of him, and the tree just kind of fell between us, and his back was turned, and it struck him right on the head. And it took him a second, you know, he kind of wobbled, didn't know what was happening, and then fell to the ground. And he had his hard hat on, thankfully. But for quite a while, because he was, you know, he was pale, he was stunned, and he said that his arm was numb, and we were really afraid that he had a spinal injury. And it was, to this day, one of the more chilling moments I've ever experienced.
Well, and then if you're in that situation, how do you get him out of there?
Yeah, so we train extensively in medical drills and extractions for this reason, because, yeah, one of the main problems with any type of injury is getting somebody out. So on our vehicles, we have backboards and we have medical gear and we have oxygen and, you know, straps and all this stuff. And luckily in this instance, the soup truck, our superintendent, the, you know, head leader.
S-U-P-T, by the way.
S-U-P-T, yes. Soup truck. Yeah, thank you. The the soup truck was just down the hill from us, you know, like maybe 50, 100 yards, not far at all. I could see it. And in addition to our buggies having backboards and straps and all of that, the soup truck has a set of those. So another guy and I, because we weren't EMTs and all the EMTs are like rushing to Luke, this other guy, Trevin, and I ran down and got the backboard and the trauma kit and all the stuff that we would need to help extract him. And then, you know, he just had to be carried just that handful of yards down the hill. But, you know, sometimes when these kinds of incidents happen, firefighters are miles out in the wilderness. And so in that case, you're looking at calling in a helicopter and just hoping you can find a place, you know, where they can extract someone. Sometimes, you know, people have to like cut out an opening in the forest with chainsaws in order for the helicopter to be able to either land or hover and pick somebody up with a long line. It's absolutely crazy trying to get somebody medical help in some of these situations.
Well, I find your book interesting on so many levels. I learned things that I thought, my goodness, I never heard of a fire chaser beetle. And you say that here's this beetle that's born from fire. And yeah. What's unusual about a fire chaser beetle?
Oh my gosh, they're so wild. So they are drawn to the burning wood in the aftermath of a wildfire, like right after a fire has passed through. And they basically have this sensor in their body. It's like a little fluid-filled sac kind of that expands when they detect the heat and smoke of the fire. They can detect a wildfire from 80 miles away. And these
I found astounding.
Yeah.
That this little insect can detect heat up to 80 miles away.
Absolutely. Wow. So impressive. I mean, objectively, they're impressive, right? And then what they do is they use that hot wood, that sort of like smoldering wood, and they lay their eggs in it, and that's how they reproduce. So it's so fascinating, but they bite human beings, and it's absolutely miserable and painful, and they will just swarm. So, you know, everybody hates these beetles. Every firefighter hates these beetles.
Now, you mentioned they're being painful, and there's something that I haven't mentioned so far, but people may wonder, well, where are Kelly's parents? What did they think about what she was doing? And can I ask you about your dad?
Yeah, of course, yeah. My parents had split up when I was about 2 years old, and I did have a relationship with my dad throughout my life, but it was basically just flying to visit him, you know, once a year. And gradually, he became an alcoholic and then became a more severe alcoholic. And over time, he, due to that choice, lost everything, pretty much. He lost his career. He had been a contractor with his own business. He lost his career, He lost a lot of friends and relationships, his marriage, and ultimately lost his home and became homeless. So that was, as you can imagine, pretty painful, a source of like deep pain and grief for me, and something that unconsciously shaped a lot of my choices. I think I did a lot of my wild adventuring was this attempt to sort of outrun that pain, or find an escape, a release, you know, find some sense of freedom and try to find myself. And then I think, you know, doing something like fire was an extension of that, but also this attempt to find a new kind of family, a better family, somewhere where I could belong and feel supported.
Well, in your dad's favor, I found it interesting. He liked to read. He read books, and he listened to NPR, National Public Radio. So your dad impressed me. Here's a guy living in Kentucky, and he's listening to National Public Radio.
I know. He's kind of an anomaly, you know, like a really smart person. Yeah, a reader, a thinker, likes really good music, listens to NPR, and yet has this sort of like redneck looking background. But, you know, he's not what he seems in many ways. Yeah, just a wonderful person. And that makes it all the more sad, you know, when somebody has a disease like alcoholism and you think like, but they're a wonderful person, you know, their life could have gone so differently.
There are a lot of things that I think are lessons for us, the reader. For example, you mentioned our deepest wounds were the fertile soil of our growth, something that feels like, oh gosh, why did this happen to me? But this can be the impetus for our growth. So I appreciated your bringing that out. Something else you mentioned, that our body tells the truth if you're willing to listen. And I found that true for myself, something that when I'm in the right place, my body just relaxes like, oh, this is it. Yeah. Or if it's not a good decision, my body will say, nah. And so I like that lesson. Your body tells the truth if you're willing to listen. Another thing you said, nature was always there for me. And a lot of people make this point that we really benefit from getting out in nature. And I remember when I walked the pilgrimage across Spain, just being out in, this was before everybody and his brother was walking it, and just being every day you get up and you walk and you go to bed, and the next day you get up and you walk, always through nature. One other thing that I thought was a lesson for us that was for you, you said, settling into my body and being alone. Now, I don't know that I could be as happy alone as you say you are, but you did say that that was something you learned that was good for you, being alone.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, there are times in life where I've also had to learn the opposite lesson, that I can be with other people and still feel safe and feel okay. But yeah, at that time, I think I really needed to learn not to rely on always having a relationship, or, you know, I needed to learn that I could stand on my own two feet. And that took some time, but I did get there.
Well, I think this book will appeal to those of us, especially in Northern California, since we live with this. But thank you for writing this book, Kelly. Let me tell listeners again, the title of your book, Wildfire Days, A Woman, A Hotshot Crew, and the Burning American West. And the author is Kelly Ramsey. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It has been wonderful to be here.
And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
On fire. The eclipse of peace, like a lion's mane, shivers a plume, elicits the distant stampede of balsams and screaming bark. This fervor is a mad deer running through a horizontal hellscape. Her eruptions unyielding, pulsing heaven against hell, melting into Earth's apparatus with no let-up, no ease. A combustible madness whose veins are oozing panic plasma. Steel snakes of cars lie tilted, a farce of getaways. This botany of hell seizes all in bric-a-brac losses of hamlets and hearth. One after another, the dominoes fall, outlines left like homicides. Amid the ash. Claudia Stedelin.
Time. Time always makes a quick escape. Its job is done. It provides opportunity, and then it moves on. Weekdays trudge along. Weekends fly by. Halloween costumes are already on display. Been 6 months since last Halloween. Long time ago or recent? Sometimes it's hard to tell. That trip you planned is coming up in 10 days. 10 days can seem an eternity for a fun vacation, or too soon for that root canal appointment coming up in 10 days. Time does not make errors. We do. Time is the same. The time it takes to complete a job often makes it fun or not, joyous or drab, rushed or relaxed. Time is a slinky, stretching long enough to get to the next level, or it's concrete compacting itself to make sure that everything is finished and jammed into a specific length. What if time could think and act? What if it remembered how you wasted it last time and now it wants to teach you a lesson? That is a fantasy, of course. Could be effective for people getting a lesson like that. Why does time take so long or pass so quickly? It's the job being completed that actually creates the time. Time doesn't hold a grudge, but it sure can teach people a lesson. In a minute, just a minute, wait a sec, in a while, are time references kids often hear. To them, a second or a minute or a while seem an eternity. What's the rush? Now that's a question parents enjoy asking kids. They always ask kids to explain why they want something sooner or later. But don't we all? We dislike having to explain the desire to have something now. It can be pretty daunting. Parents feel when kids make quick decisions, they suffer through frustration, setbacks, and failure. So what's the rush? Seems a logical question to a parent. To a child, not so much. Time has a long history. It has been with us since, well, the beginning of time. If that does not qualify it as its own expert, what does? Time, you wear me out. You tend to do that. You can be a friend for certain, but more often, you are just an elusive foe. Mark Malinger.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.